This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
When you have soldiers or policemen or other paramilitary units who do not know how to manage non-violent, non-political crisis without resorting to lethal force, the problem you have is widespread abuses, especially when the laws are vague and ambiguous.
That's Mousi Sugan, Africa Continental Director on Security Forces, using deadly beatings and other extreme force to enforce coronavirus lockdowns. Details coming up. Also, the World Food Program warns the coronavirus pandemic is increasing the hunger in the Middle East and North Africa. And Cameroon's traditional healers are overwhelmed by the number of people seeking herbal medicine to fight the coronavirus. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Across Africa, civil society groups say governments are committing human rights violations because of the COVID-19 crisis. In some countries, security forces have killed people who allegedly disobeyed regulations supposed to limit coronavirus infections. Analysts say what was once only a health crisis is now also a rapidly escalating human rights tragedy. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
About 2 weeks ago, security forces streamed into this alley in Alexandra Township in Johannesburg. Their target was resident Collins Khoza. They accused him of breaking South Africa's COVID-19 lockdown law by drinking alcohol in the street with friends. Khoza's wife, Nomsa, says police and soldiers beat him until he lay in the dirt.
He couldn't wake up. He was just sleeping and then vomiting a little bit. That's when I started to clean him. I realized that he's not breathing.
An army spokesman, General Monwabisi Jamangile, later said the law should take its course in such cases.
No one is subject to be beaten, and no one is subject to provoke and be ill-disciplined to the security forces. You, the media.
Human Rights Watch says the general's response is typical of militaries in Africa. It basically says, don't mess with us or else. The problem, says the group's continental director, Mousi Segun, is that African security forces mostly know only one way, violence.
When you have soldiers or policemen or other paramilitary units who do not know how to manage non-violent, non-political crisis without resorting to lethal force, the problem you have is widespread abuses, especially when the laws are vague and ambiguous.
Segun uses Rwanda as an example. It has banned unnecessary movements and visits outside the home.
What does that even mean? A shopping trip to the market, is that a visit outside the home? Is it a necessary movement? So you've seen people have been stopped on their way to shop for groceries and they are beaten by police.
Because the restrictions aren't clear, says Segun, individual police officers and soldiers must try to interpret them, often resulting in confusion and violence. In Abuja, Nigeria, where she lives, Segun says she recently watched the police stop a man for being outside unnecessarily.
He stripped himself to his underpants to show the police who were arresting him that he had nothing on him except the cash that he was taking to go shop for food for his family. Yet he was arrested, tried, and sentenced to 6 months community service. That is an abuse, because if food is not necessary, what is necessary?
Segun says many African political leaders are promoting violence as a legitimate way to prevent the spread of the virus. Kenya and South Africa are just two places where security forces have shot and killed people under emergency regulations.
Why are police allowed to use live bullets to enforce restrictions around a public health crisis? So the attempt to enforce the restrictions to keep people safe from getting infected and dying from an infection is ending up killing more people than the infection itself.
During states of disaster, says Segun, when people are already scared and suffering, it's important for the authorities to win citizens' trust, engage with them, and educate them respectfully.
We need everyone's cooperation. It is for their protection and the protection of everyone in the community. And I dare say across the world that we have people obey these rules, but the means with which we persuade them, and that's the key word, persuasion, has to change. It cannot be the language of force.
Her organization advocates the use of groups other than the police and military to encourage adherence to COVID-19 restrictions. One of these is active in Abuja.
They are called civil defense. It's a paramilitary unit. Most of them do not carry any arms. What they do is to come in when they see people flouting the rules. They speak to you, they encourage you to go back home, and you will see people comply.
Segun says previous Ebola outbreaks and now COVID-19 have proven that using violence to enforce emergency restrictions only serves to cause civil disobedience and so creating conditions for a disease to spread. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The World Food Programme warns the COVID-19 pandemic threatens to boost the number of hungry people in the Middle East and North African region to more than 47 million, an increase of more than 6.7 million from current figures. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
This region has been mired in conflict, political instability, and economic problems for years. COVID-19 is compounding these difficulties. UN agencies warn fragile and dysfunctional governments in the Middle East and North Africa are ill-equipped to deal with the pandemic and its impact. The World Food Programme's Global Report on Food Crises notes 20% of people around the world suffering from acute food shortages are to be found in the Middle East. WFP spokeswoman Elizabeth Beers says the report predicts the pandemic will increase extreme hunger and that many more people in the region will struggle to feed themselves as their means of livelihood disappear.
With little to no saving, no employment insurance, reduced food subsidies, people who engage in subsistence or informal work to support their families cannot endure sustained lockdowns. Many of the people receiving food assistance rely on it for their survival.
The World Food Programme currently provides food to 23 million people in the region. More than two-thirds of this assistance is being channeled to people in Yemen and Syria who have been racked by war, illness, and hunger for years. WFP reports nearly 3.8 million children in 11 countries are no longer receiving school meals following school closures across the region, depriving most of the children of their only nutritious meal of the day. The UN Food Agency says it is finding alternative ways to make up for these missed meals in 9 of the 11 countries. These include the provision of take-home rations and home delivery of food. In some cases, WFP provides families with cash or vouchers they can use to buy food in local markets. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
While most countries in North Africa have not learned much from Europe's failure to respond adequately to the coronavirus pandemic, Morocco's prime minister initially told the population to relax and go about their lives normally. But the Moroccan king swiftly created a special fund of more than $1 billion to address the pandemic. Strict measures to counter the outbreak came hand in hand with the king's vision. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Elizabeth Myers, an American professor of law and founding editor-in-chief of Inside Arabia News, living in Morocco, about actions taken to counter coronavirus in the country.
I think what it reflects actually is an incredibly astute vision of King Mohammed VI to address a situation that he saw developing in Europe. And Morocco has a very close relationship with France and oftentimes will follow what they're doing. I think that the king was able to see how things were going in Europe rapidly, how they were transforming in the United States rapidly, and decided that it would be best for his country, his people, and his economy to basically establish a state of emergency, which he did, also at the same time as he announced this special fund, which, by the way, has now probably quadrupled in terms of the billions of dollars that he originally allocated to it. And so he was very wise to establish essentially a state of emergency beginning on March the 20th. And there have been a number of provisions that the king put into place, basically being more of a visionary than the Islamist government that we have in place here in Morocco at the moment.
So how do you assess Moroccan response to the pandemic so far?
The emergency procedures were put into place early, quickly, and strongly. I've been calling it a lockdown, and from the measures, if people were observing them, yes, it would be a lockdown. People are supposed to be only staying indoors with their families and basically one person going out to shop and do the necessary, whether it's the pharmacy, whether it's to obtain medical treatment. And those are in place. And a mandatory mask wearing is in place. Social distancing is also supposed to be in place, but it's extremely counterculture here. In terms of how close you stand to somebody is much closer than the comfortable distance than one would have in the United States or even Europe. So what's been done is many of the supermarkets and pharmacies have actually put lines on the floor showing the people where they're supposed to stand in the queues. So these measures have been in effect. Also, an intercity, there's no movement without special permits. The only way you can go intercity is to go now to get a special piece of paper that allows you to travel from city to city. So there are checkpoints around the major cities. There are also checkpoints within cities like Casablanca and Marrakesh.
So how did the pandemic impact the Moroccan economy in particular?
The impact on the economy so far is tremendous, especially on small businesses and individuals who rely on tourism. Tourism has been about anywhere between 15 and 19% of the economy, depending on how you calculate it. And given the fact that the international borders have been closed down, there's been no tourism activity at all, except for those stranded tourists who are still here. You know, the major tourist centers like Marrakesh, the desert where people go for desert excursions, everything is dead in terms of tourism. So the impact so far has been very bad, and I expect it will continue to be very bad because it's going to take a long time once the borders are reopened to ramp up and for people to have the confidence to come back.
Do you have any idea about how many cases are now in Morocco?
Yes, there are 6,038 cases of COVID-19 according to the officially reported numbers. 58,798 people have been tested negative. So the testing has ramped up considerably in the last 2 weeks, really. There have been 188 deaths and, according to the official numbers, 2,500 recoveries. So that represents about a 3.1% death rate so far based on the reported numbers. But while I'm glad that the testing has ramped up here over the last couple of weeks, it's still not enough with a population of about 37 million in Morocco and probably another couple of 100,000 tourists who come through here, and many of whom have been stranded, and a number of whom actually have decided not to go back to their countries because it has become clear that Morocco is safer than the developed countries in Europe, such as France and Italy, and certainly the United States.
That was VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy speaking with Elizabeth Byers, an American professor of law and founding editor-in-chief of Inside Arabia News, living in Morocco. As the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in Tanzania rises to more than 500, critics have gone after authorities for their handling of the pandemic and a lack of transparency. Charles Kombe reports from Dar es Salaam.
Unlike other African cities, Tanzania's economic capital, Dar es Salaam, remains open for business, even though schools are closed and public gatherings are prohibited. This has led some to criticize authorities for adopting comparatively weaker measures against the coronavirus and for not providing regular updates on infections. Fish trader Sajda Muhammad says, with the government showing little concern, she's taking fewer precautions. Many citizens are not getting proper information about the coronavirus, she says, adding that you may hear that the coronavirus no longer exists, but on that side, two people have died. On the other, one person is dead. Sajda says she used to wear a mask properly, but now she's just wearing it on her ears because they did not get information. Tanzania's Opposition Alliance for Change and Transparency, ACT Party, has strongly criticized the government's handling of the pandemic as too secretive at the expense of public health. Zito Kabwe is a leader of the ACT Party.
If you don't provide updates, you are telling people that the problem is over. So people are no longer taking precautions. People continue their business as usual. I have seen funerals of people where you have huge amount of people for funeral services, which is very dangerous.
Tanzania's government dismisses criticism over its lack of coronavirus infection updates. Prime Minister Kassim Majaliwa cautioned against the tendency of some people to issue false statistics that lead to unnecessary unrest in society. We know we have diseases like high blood pressure, malaria, diabetes, HIV and others that also kill, he says, adding that people should leave the number of deaths to be provided by our experts. Some citizens like Lodiu Samson support the delay of information. They believe doing so reduces panic over the disease. He says the issue of delaying updates does not affect him in any way, and he sees that as a good thing. Samson asks that they live peacefully and do their business. But battling the coronavirus requires updated information, says Leopold Mosha, a Tanzanian rights activist. He says their enemy is COVID-19. So now, when they are trying to curb COVID-19, and trying to make sure there are no new infections, they should provide updates on time. Meanwhile, Sajda continues selling fish so she can feed her family, knowing they are all in danger of contracting the virus. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam.
Charles Darwin once said the ability to adapt is more critical to surviving in a changing environment than physical or intellectual strength. As such, COVID-19 has become unfamiliar territory for all, which may cripple or shut down organizations and entities that fail to adapt to the new reality. Life may never be the same, but a youth nonprofit organization in Zimbabwe is determined to keep virtual doors open despite the pandemic. Reporter Kuzai Zanwashi has the details.
Sam Farai Monroe is the creative director and co-founder of the Magamba Network. He says organizations in Zimbabwe have been resilient amid the outbreak.
In terms of civic space in Zimbabwe under COVID-19, unfortunately, it's obviously because of the lockdown forced a lot of civics and activists to be at home. I think it's constrained a lot of civic and activist activity, but at the same time, I think there have been a lot of innovative organizations that have taken their work virtually and digitally to hold the government to account. And I think that's been key because the Mnangagwa government has been using this the COVID period to once again try and to entrench its rule.
The ongoing lockdown has seen many nonprofit organization employees working from home and some waiting for the lockdown to end. Monroe says Magamba Network has been equally affected.
As Magamba Network, we work on the cutting edge of arts, digital media, activism, and innovation. So we already do a lot of digital work, but at the same time, we do a lot of offline and physical activities, from running a creative hub to doing a lot of kind of outreach programs. The lockdown has affected how we work because we've had to shut our creative hub and shut our offices, stop all our kind of outreach programming, and everyone is working from home.
But the work continues. Mondro says they have had to rethink how to fulfill their mandate.
Because of the lockdown, we've had to really innovate and come up with some brand new virtual programming. We've come up with many different programs. For example, through our Model Republic Creative Hub, we launched Zimbabwe's first ever digital poetry slam, where we had the country's top poets battling it out online. We did that in partnership with Page Poetry Alive.
The programs are vast. They run an artist accelerator program, pushing for collaborations between artists while at home, live Facebook concerts that attract thousands of viewers as musicians perform from home. The Magamba Network has also been working on a local COVID-19 tracker that keeps information up to date and another tracker that monitors donations. Monroe says the migration online has not been without challenges, with the high cost of data and an unreliable network. But he says the challenges are outweighed by the benefits of bringing alternative information sources to young people in their homes while they're in lockdown. For VOA, this is Kudzezi Nawashe from Harare.
Mozambique's Constitutional Court has declared null and void loans worth $1.4 billion. The AFP news agency says the country's state-owned security companies borrowed the money in 2013 to 2014 from Swiss banking giant Credit Suisse and Russia's VTB Bank, who argue that the government is liable for the debt. But Mozambique's court ruled yesterday that the loans were illegal because they were not approved by Parliament. Sarah Jane Clifton of the British-based Jubilee Debt Campaign, which works for debt cancellation of poor countries, agrees with the court ruling. She says Mozambique's people had no say over the matter and got no benefit from the loans, therefore they should not have to pay 1 cent. According to a Reuters report, the loans taken by two Mozambican state companies were for a project spanning tuna fishing and maritime security. However, U.S. authorities say it was an elaborate front for a bribery and a kickback scheme. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thanks again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.